But on behalf of EAA AirVenture, we welcome you to the celebration of the 75th anniversary of the United States Air Force. Innovate, accelerate, and thrive. Three words that encompass the very best of what our Air Force has to offer. Our distinguished panel tonight represents valor, bravery, and commitment to service for others. Please turn your attention to the screens.
From its inception, the Air Force has excelled at keeping pace with rapid changes. Now, more than ever, you must accelerate change and prepare for the future because failure is not an option. Empowered airmen are a competitive edge over adversaries and the reason we are the world's greatest Air Force. Airmen will always be there to provide America with the air power it needs to defend the nation, help diplomacy proceed from a position of strength, reassure our partners and allies, and deter or defeat our adversaries. This year marks our 75th anniversary. And my hope is that Americans across the country and across the globe have the opportunity to see the U.S. Air Force in action as we celebrate this historic milestone. Happy anniversary to the greatest Air Force in the history of the world.
Our Air Force was built on the backs of heroes, tireless in the pursuit of excellence. I am humbled and honored to introduce you now to tonight's panelists. I welcome to the stage Major John Lucky Luckadoo, a World War II bomber pilot who flew the B-17 Flying Fortress over France and Germany. Come on out, sir. A standing ovation. Thank you.
Thank you.
He is the last living original pilot of the World War II 8th Air Force 100th Bomb Group, known as the Bloody 100th, which suffered high casualties. He joined the Army after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in December 1941, and he recently shared a story in his new book, Damn Lucky, by war correspondent Kevin Moore. Thank you so much for being here and speaking to the crowd tonight. We appreciate you, and thank you for your service.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. For those of you who were wandering over here, perhaps you heard a very loud jet making a lot of noise. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce you to our next panelist, also a friend of mine. We welcome to the stage Major Kristen Bayo-Wolf, the commander of the F-35A Lightning II demonstration team. Come on out. It's not lost on me that Haley is in the audience now attending your panel. Haley was speaking on a panel of female mechanics earlier, and Bayo is in attendance, so I see Haley in the audience, which is great. The mission of the F-35 demo team is to showcase the really unique aerial capabilities of the Air Force's most advanced fifth-generation multi-role stealth fighter. Major Wolf, Bayo, provides operational oversight and direction for her 13-personnel team and entered the Air Force in 2011. She is an experienced fighter pilot with more than 1,300 flying hours in the F-22 Raptor and the F-35. Before we welcome our final panelists, please take a moment to watch this video.
When I'm flying, I put my helmet on, my visor down, my mask up. You don't know who I am, whether I'm African-American, Asian-American, Hispanic, white, male or female. You just know I'm an American airman, kicking your butt. I'm General C.Q. Brown, Jr. Come join us.
Please welcome to the stage right now, General C.Q. Brown, Jr., Chief of Staff of the Air Force.
Thank
Steph and Oshkosh, thank you for such a warm welcome. As you know, today it's a Air Force only panel to honor our 75th anniversary. And I think about a quote from Eleanor Roosevelt that said, the beauty of our dreams is those that we believe in. And the aspect of our dream of a United States Air Force came 44 years after the Wright Flyers flew. And I'm really honored to be able to join on stage with some Air Force icons and spend a little time talking to you about our United States Air Force and for the three of us here to help represent the nearly 689,000 active Guard and Reserve and civilian airmen that allow us to execute the mission of the United States Air Force, to fly, fight, and win air power anytime, anywhere. And so it's a great honor for us to be here and spend time. This is my first time to Oshkosh. I hope to come back. And I really do appreciate your support for us and your how you get the dream of aviation to so many that have a chance to maybe serve in our United States Air Force, our military, or the aviation career fields. Thank you and look forward to the tonight's event.
General Brown, I think the first question I'll deliver to you, you have said that we must accelerate change or lose. Tell me what that means. What perspective can this audience benefit from understanding that concept?
Well, we think about our security and where we are today and our national defense strategy that outlines the People's Republic of China is our pacing challenge. Russia is an acute threat. We're also focused on North Korea, Iran, and violent extremism. And the aspect of what we've been doing as the United States Air Force for the past 30 years, primarily focused in the Middle East, and thinking about our adversaries of the future. And from that perspective, we cannot continue to operate in the same way we do today. In order to be prepared for the threats we start to see today, the threats we'll see 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, we're going to have to change. And I really think if the aspect of losing is, personally and professionally, I do not play for second place. And our United States Air Force doesn't play for second place. And from that aspect, then, we've got to make sure we're making change to stay ahead of our adversaries. Because we don't want to lose in a major conflict. We don't want to lose in competition. We don't want to lose our credibility. And we definitely don't want to lose our airmen and families that want to serve with us. And so that drives change. It's why we've got to continue to drive change. And if I said accelerate and win, then it's, you know, no one gets excited. But if I say and talk about losing and knowing we don't want to lose, it's an aspect that actually motivates people to move forward and get some things done to help us change. And we're making some progress in aspects of the Air Force, but I'd still tell you we've got some ways to go.
Question for you and for Bayo. What type of aircraft and weaponry do we need to get ahead of the game in the fight as you're referencing this? What needs to happen?
I know from an operator perspective, I think anything that can maximize our lethality cheaper, more effectively, faster at the hands of one single person because we just don't have the amount of people sometimes that we need or are afforded. And so I don't have specifics. Obviously, drones with tons of missiles next to me flying around would be amazing as I go into combat because I can only be so stealthy with four missiles in my bay right now. So. Those are kind of small things that I can think of that we need for, night one of a conflict that we're seeing continually come online, especially as they get added to the F-35, for example.
Yeah, what I would add to that is the F-35 is going to be the cornerstone of our fighter fleet. And that's just one aspect with the other fighters, but it's all the other capabilities that the United States Air Force provides. And one of the areas that we will continue to look at is autonomy. And as Bayo kind of highlighted, one of the things we're looking at is a collaborative combat aircraft where someone in an F-35 or another platform can be a quarterback with a number of uncrewed platforms that can be a decoy, they can be a weapons carrier, they can be a sensor. And it's the aspect of how we use the technology that we have. And I think maybe some of the technology we see here at Oshkosh, it kind of comes together. And it's the aspect of innovation. And that's something that's been a key part of how the United States Air Force has operated over time, is the great innovation to be able to move forward. And so there's a balance. And one of the questions I often get is, will we still have as many fighter pilots? And as fighter pilots, we don't want to let that go, but we're going to have to start changing in some areas and use technology to help drive us forward in many areas. And then the last thing I'd say is just the quality of our airmen. Those that get into STEM type education and how important that is to allow us to be able to move forward as an Air Force.
The changing face of the airmen is certainly something that's front of mind. And we will come out to your questions. Our question takers are heading out to the floor. So by all means, if you do have a question, just raise your hand and someone will walk over to you with the microphone. We've got a gentleman there and Margaret over there to take your questions if you would like to ask them. But to that point, I think it was 2020 when Beale actually conducted a flight using artificial intelligence. You're talking about STEM careers and engineering and the work that goes into coding. And that AI in that aircraft actually successfully completed some sensor and navigation tasks. So again, it's not about losing the airmen, it's about helping the airmen. Major Luckadoo, the grit and the passion and the commitment to service that you and all of the people you served with brought to the fight is the stuff of legends and movies. And you've written a book. What do you want people to take away from your story?
My hope is that my book will help current generations realize the futility of war, the total folly that war produces, that it is unproductive, it's only destructive. And having served proudly as a patriot to my country, I realized from this vantage point, which I did not necessarily realize at the time, that I was a guinea pig, that I was a member of a force that was simply trying to prove a strategy of bombing and destroying an enemy. I'm now a raging pacifist because I realize the total futility of going out and trying to kill your enemy. I think the saddest thing about our society today is that as human beings, we're unable to resolve our differences without resorting to armed conflict. The situation in Ukraine is certainly a prime example. But when you consider that wars are started by old men, and today are fought by young men and women. So I hope that my book will bring to the fore the fact that anybody going to war and being shot at will not come back the same person.
Thank you. A question for really both General Brown as well as Major Wolf. And it dovetails off something he said. You never pick a fight with the biggest kid on the playground. So I want to talk about the idea of having a robust military as a deterrent to keep you out of war because people don't want to show up for that fight. How do you see the United States Air Force growing in that capacity over the next several decades?
Well, part of it is having some of the advanced capabilities that we highlighted here just a few minutes ago, so we can stay ahead of our adversary and having a good understanding of where they're heading and what they're doing. I think the other part that I also think about is not just the weapon system, but it's understanding how our adversary, what influences their behavior. And deterrence is not only about the military capabilities, it's about understanding what they value and how you hold that at risk, so we don't go into conflict. And Lucky actually really hit on it. Our goal is not to go to war.
Right.
Our goal is to make it so hard that our adversaries go, it's not worth it. And that's a key part of it. The other thing that's not just the U.S. military, it's the aspect of the things we do with our allies and partners. And that's one thing that the United States has that our adversaries don't have. And we have a lot of friends that we work with on a regular basis, and that's the power of all those coming together. We see that a bit of that, what's going on in Ukraine, how the international community's come together. We've seen it in past conflicts, but I see it day to day in how we were able to operate. Matter of fact, I was just in Europe here about 2 weeks ago with 67 of my friends, air chiefs from around the world, and spent a lot of time talking to them about how we can work together to ensure global security.
Major Wolf, as someone who has flown both the F-22 and the F-35, I would like your perspective as an operator on the idea of a deterrent. The capabilities that sensor fusion and the things that the F-35 brings to the fight provides a very comprehensive battle space picture for our allies and ourselves. Tell me a little bit about the need to continue developing that technology, perhaps even sixth gen, whatever's coming in the future that I don't have a security clearance to know about, but talk about that, please.
Sure. I think being a, we call a fifth gen baby, you are used to being used as a deterrent in theater security packages, traveling around the world, you know, and I think something that I've seen change personally in the last couple of years is the ACE concept. So agile combat of moving around small packages of F-35s, F-22s, putting them under control of, you know, a young captain or a young major, and telling them, hey, I need you to move this here, be a deterrent here, and this half of the squadron is going to go here. And it's showing our adversaries that we are basically agile, we're flexible, and we can react to anything. So hopefully we can be that strong deterrent. And just like you hit on with the fifth gen sensors and fusion and all that kind of stuff, we're now putting kids straight out of pilot training into F-35s, putting them 20 miles off my wing and asking them to make very big decisions when they're out there on the front line. So we're pushing that boundary for those young wingmen, and it's really important, but I've seen it grow in the last 7 years I've been flying these airplanes significantly in the last couple.
Do we have a question in the back? Hi, Margaret. Oh, we might be having trouble with that microphone. There it is. It's on now.
What are the qualities that the Air Force is looking for?
What a great question.
What we're really looking for.
What are the qualities that the Air Force is looking for?
People that love to serve. And that's the key part. It's an all-volunteer force. You've got to be willing to serve. And I think the other aspect is for the young man back there, you got to do well in school. And that helps you to be part of our Air Force. But it's being willing to serve and be part of a team. And I think that's a couple of key aspects I would offer.
Great question. Major Luckadoo, we are here to celebrate the Air Force's 75th anniversary. And I would like to know one of the memories you are most proud of during your service.
Well, certainly my memory of having served in the Air Force at a historic time. I accidentally became a part of history because of my age and the time that I served in World War II, when our values and our freedom was attacked. And of course, under those circumstances, we have no recourse but to respond. But my best memories, of course, are serving with my contemporaries, who were, of course, vastly different than the members of the Air Force today. Flying today is so much more sophisticated and is a much different situation altogether. It's so technologically advanced, and so is warfare, and so is preparation, and the efforts that we make to discourage attack is certainly so profound that we should be aware that we have to guard against not only external but internal threats to our freedoms. And keep that in mind.
Before I get out to the next question, I'm curious, Major Wolf, tell me about your role with the demo, because it's interesting. It certainly creates personal memories, but you become the biggest business card that the Air Force has to offer. What does that mean to be out there and be such an inspiration for men and women who want to fly and maybe want to serve?
Yeah, that was actually my answer to your previous question is probably the most rewarding thing I have ever done in my career is this job, and it's the collection of little tiny moments. And it's, you know, hanging out at our swag tent, watching little kids come up and say, poke their parents and say, Mommy, can I do that one day? And you tell them, yes, you can do that. You can do so many things. It just takes them seeing and getting that little glimpse in their eye of seeing someone that looks like them, talks like them, was from the same place as them doing that job that they aspire to do one day. So that's what I get out of this job. And it is the business card, but it's personally rewarding to every single person on my team.
General Brown, I have to ask you, because you've got more than 2,900 flying hours in the F-16. You have this storied career. How are you going to pick a memory that's a favorite, given everything you do?
Actually, I would kind of play on Bayo's kind of comment. There's a series of small memories throughout my career. I would highlight maybe a couple in broad specs. First of all, it's all the people I've got a chance to know. Many of my best friends and their families, our kids grew up together. All those kind of come together. But there's one here that, as I became the chief of staff of the Air Force, that really stands out to me. I've always kind of followed as a ski airman. And about 2 weeks after I became the chief of staff of the Air Force, I was going to tape a video for the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. And we're gonna do it out at the National Mall, pretty close to the Lincoln Memorial. And I was doing it with General Charles McGee. And he was already at the site where we're gonna do the video. And when I walked up, at this point, he was 100 years old. He stood up and he said he was so honored to meet me. And I was so honored to meet him. We kept going back and forth about who was more honored to meet each other. And then after we taped the video, he and I went up into the Lincoln Memorial and stood and talked for about 15 minutes. And his son and daughter, one of his daughters are here, and I had a chance to talk to him today. So I built a relationship with the McGee family. And I was very honored to speak at his memorial service and then at his funeral here just last month was to be able to officiate and provide the family the flag that draped his coffin. And so all that is something that really sticks out to me because I know how much the Tuskegee Airmen mean to me. So that's what really stands out.
That does. Thank you for sharing that. Do we have a question over there?
Right up in the middle here.
Question for Major Barrett. Describe the roles that your support team plays so that you could do your job?
Yeah, thank you for asking. A lot of times the plane and the pilot get all the glory. That's who everybody claps for at the end. But there takes a team that we take on the road every single air show to prepare that plane, put it in the air, do all the narration and music that the crowd loves to hear, and then take care of that plane after I fly it. So. On the air show road, we bring 10 people total. Two of those are pilots that bring out the airplanes. Six of those are maintainers, a variety of crew chiefs, avionics, weapons troops. We bring an aircrew flight equipment technician that takes care of my gear that I wear, all my survival gear, my G suit, my helmet. And then we take one public affairs individual that is able to capture those moments at an air show and broadcast them over social media. So it takes a team for sure to make that one 15-minute flight happen. And we're thankful every day, and then that's why we take people on the road as well to try to show them that, hey, pilots are get all the glory sometimes, but there are so many jobs in the Air Force that kids can aspire to be one day and to have that career. And it doesn't all of it's involved in aviation, obviously, in the Air Force, but that they can put a plane in the air in some capacity, and so that's super important for us for our mission.
Great question, thank you. I think General Brown, this sort of dovetails into things that are important to highlight, which is the diversity of our service members in the forces. How has, over the course of your career, how has the Air Force really grown and reshaped itself to reflect modern society?
Well, this is one thing that I would say the military has done over our history. And you can go back to the Tuskegee Airmen and the fact that in 1948 with the integration of the services, but I also take a look at how throughout my career, when I first came in, women couldn't fly fighters, and now they can today. The aspect of how we really look to break down barriers across our Air Force in so many different ways. And I'll just say we've had a pretty big focus over the course of the past couple of years after George Floyd's death to take a hard look at ourselves. And the real goal is we want to be reflective of the nation we serve, have those that share our values come be part of our Air Force. We want it to be to a point where young people look up, they can see somebody that looks like them. In key positions or have those opportunities. And the whole goal for me is to provide opportunities so everyone that joins the Air Force can reach their full potential. And the goal is breaking down some barriers and looking at some of our policies to ensure that we don't have any barriers to make it easy for those that want to serve.
Major Luckadoo, I want to ask you about the first time you flew the B-17. Take me back.
Well, I have to smile because the Bloody 100 Bomb Group experienced something that no other group in the 8th Air Force ever did. And that was that after their crews had been prepared through various training programs to go overseas, all of the co-pilots were replaced by graduates of my flying school class, 40 of us. We were sent to this one bomb group. This never happened to any other group, and nobody has ever explained. I'd like to get my hands on who thought it up, but nobody has ever explained the strategy or the reasoning or the purpose in doing this. But my first time to fly a B-17, which I had never been in before. I graduated from a multi-engine flying school in a twin-engine trainer. I was suddenly thrust into the right-hand seat as the second in command of a 10-man crew. And I had no familiarity with the crew and certainly no familiarity with the airplane. So we were forced, being thrust in this position, to learn our trade on the job. When I departed the States flying toward combat, I had less than 20 hours in a B-17. And so we learned on the job, and we had to become a member of a team. We were obviously the weakest member of the chain, having been just thrust in the position that we were in. But that was my first time to fly a B-17.
That's remarkable. Thank you for sharing.
There's obviously some similarities with modern day aircraft between what we're flying now and what other countries are now building. They look so similar. I'm sure the capabilities are still not the same, but how can we plug some of those holes of technology loss?
Yeah, so I guess what I'd hit on, couple things on the technology piece and the aspect that, you know, a lot of our research and development used to be done inside of the Department of Defense. And there's a lot of research and development that's done outside of the Department of Defense. And one of the real goals we have is how do we work more closely with those outside of the Department of Defense in the tech sector, corporate sector, to look at some of the good ideas they have and bring it into the Air Force. And this is an area, when I talk about accelerating, this is an area that we got to accelerate on. It just takes us too long to bring some things in because it's a lot of things are happening outside the Air Force and outside the Department of Defense that we can bring in. And that's an aspect of our nation that we can come together and do that very quickly versus our adversaries. What our adversaries don't have is the quality people that actually are able to go do things. And one of the things we have as an Air Force and as a nation is a strong non-commissioned officer corps. And those are the ones that make things happen. Bale talked about her team. Those are all strong non-commissioned officers that actually have a lot of empowerment. We completely trust them. And not every nation is able to do that. And our adversaries are not like that. And that's that is not a technical piece. It's just our culture as a nation and how we trust our airmen to be able to do the job. And that's what I think will, I'm confident will give us an edge. And it's the quality over the quantity, not only of our people, but also some of the technology we have. But we got to work more closely together with the industry to bring things into the Air Force and get into the hands of our airmen much quicker than we do today.
Thank you for the question. And before, Margaret, I've lost sight of you, but I'll come
to you. I'm right
in
the middle.
Okay, perfect. But I do, Bayo, you can talk to this a little bit. Tell me what you studied and specialized in when you were in high school and college.
I went to a magnet program high school, so a lot of AP classes. And then I went to the University of Alabama. I did chemical engineering while I was there, as well as ROTC. And then mostly just focused, math, science, STEM things that didn't exist, 12 years ago, which I've also been so thankful to have been a part of so many STEM things that have been happening over the last 5 years, because I think it's so important to expose kids to that. You're seeing STEM, buildings on base where they're bringing in fifth graders, and we go there all the time just to see those kids working on robotics and 3D printing and space, and those aren't things that I had 10 years ago, but I think that's what we need to accelerate and bring those kids into the Air Force. But chemical engineering.
I absolutely agree. We've watched, to your point, we've watched other countries develop robust engineering and math curriculums at the school level, and it is just simply a part of, it's culturally what's done. And here, with the freedoms that we have a lot more flexibility, if you will. And so I do agree that pursuing STEM and making STEM exciting and interesting is a great way to hook people, as opposed to simply telling them that it's something they're going to do, which as a parent doesn't always work the way you want it to. Go ahead, you have a question.
All right.
I think the first time I heard your patented It's Showtime was last year at Deke Slayton, so thanks for coming to Oshkosh. Question for the general. With the rate of change in technology growth and AI just growing so exponentially, from your perspective, how do you move to where you think the puck will be when it comes to design and procurement and development with all the defense contractors and coming up with next air dominance, piece of machinery?
Yeah, there's two things that I would highlight. One of the things that when I wrote Accelerate Change or Lose, one of the key words in there was collaboration. And it kind of goes back to the previous questions. How we collaborate that those are actually doing AI on a day-to-day basis. Think about when you go on and search for something on Amazon. Well, sooner than you finish, there's something showing up that's trying to hook you. Or you're getting shows recommended as you watch Netflix or Hulu or whatever. That's AI. And there's folks that are doing that on a regular basis that we can actually bring in and have a better understanding, better collaboration with the industry to bring that along. The other part that we have to think about is how we do our acquisition process, because we've been very hardware focused, where we try to de-risk whatever we're going to build and make it perfect, so it takes a long time to actually get it into the field. When you're doing software, it's never finished. And so it's a little bit of a culture shift that we got to be able to think about how you do a viable product, nor are you going to continue to upgrade it over time. And that's a part that we're focused on, and how we use aspects of digital engineering and digital design, open mission systems, DevSecOps, which is actually software development, and how do you bring that into our Air Force. The challenge we have sometimes is folks are looking to see things parked on a ramp, seeing an airplane, and you can't measure software and do the oversight that someone would do for software the same way you do it for airplanes. And so there is a bit of a culture shift we have to get to. We're slowly getting there. I think we could go a bit faster, and there's a lot we can learn from the tech sector that in some cases things aren't gonna work and it's gonna fail. And that's how you learn. And those are the things we gotta continue to do to move forward. Thanks for the question.
Fear of failure often leads to an inability to innovate.
Exactly.
You have to try it, and you have to be prepared to accept that failure if you're really going to push the boundaries to get to the next level.
Right.
Yeah. Question over here.
We have a question from a young lady down here to your right.
I got a question for a girl. What does it feel like to fly a plane upside down?
What does it feel like?
What does it feel like?
To fly upside down.
That's awesome. It's like flying a roller coaster.
Do you think you want to fly upside down someday? Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
We've got a job for you. Margaret, you've got a question over
yep,
there.
Yep, I got a question over here on the left.
Yeah, I have a question for General Brown. I started my career in flight test out in Edwards, and now I essentially continue to serve in the civilian capacity in the aerospace industry supporting our military. When I got started in the 80s, and we're about the same age, we were pretty good at acquisition. We took aircraft like the F-15E and the B-1B and the air-launched cruise missiles, and we got them out there quickly. They were good capabilities. They were reasonably on schedule and reasonably on budget, and it seems like we've lost the recipe. I mean, the F-35 is a good airplane, but it's vastly over budget. It took forever to get into service. The KC-46 is a disaster. I mean, it may be a good airplane eventually, but it just, you know, it's taking forever. What went wrong with acquisition, and what are we going to do to make it right?
Yeah, I'd maybe challenge you a little bit on the KC-46 being a disaster. I've actually flown the aircraft, and it's got some challenges. And this is the whole aspect. We're looking to make things perfect versus letting it get out in the field and get it tested. And that's the same thing I would say for, in some aspects, the way we've operated. The real challenge is we haven't really had a threat for the past 30 years. After the wall came down, I think we lost a little bit of focus. And this is why when we start talking about the threat we have today, we got to regain our focus as a nation, how we come together to drive change and to accelerate getting things in the hands of our airmen. That's what we have to be able to do. And this is why it's so important that we work very much more closely with industry. And one of the areas that we're working through with for those that have heard about the Operation in Paris that our Secretary of the Air Force has put together, is we're taking an operational lead with an acquisition technical lead and having them work very closely together. We typically would have the operators come up with a requirement and give it to the acquisition professionals. They would build something that's not exactly what we wanted, and that's why the back and forth, why it takes so long. And by having close collaboration, we're able to move faster. And one of the examples I would give to you, which is not quite out yet, but the B-21 is a good example where we have operators working very closely with the industry and acquisition to move things forward. I think there's also a bit of a cultural shift. We have all the authorities we need from an acquisition standpoint, but we don't use those because we built a culture of trying to make everything risk-free, which really drives the timeline, the cost, and so we've got to be able to take a little risk to be able to move forward. And I think that's the way we're going to get there. And we have to work with Congress as well because they have a vote on this, actually a pretty big vote on this, and that's an area that I spent a lot of time over on the Hill engaging with members and staffers to actually help break down some of those barriers to help us move forward.
Thank you for your question. Major Luckadoo, before I come to a question over here, when you look to the sky and you see the F-35 flying and you think about your legacy as a B-17 pilot, what are your thoughts that the technology that's present today in our modern military is amazing?
It's not only amazing, it's awesome. Certainly the quantum leap that has been made in technology and the type of flying, and when I see Major make a demonstration in a F-35 or an F-22, I think, well, they're having all the fun. Anybody going into the Air Force or wanting to fly usually wants to be a fighter pilot. Not everybody qualifies. A fighter pilot has to have an entirely different set of skills and develop a different set of skills and attitudes and reflexes, but they don't have any responsibility for anybody but themselves. Perhaps a wingman, but basically they're free to roam the skies at supersonic speed and do things that we only dreamed about. And the contrast of what we did and the type of aircraft we were flying, unpressurized and so primitive. when you look at it, we were just two jumps beyond the Wright brothers. literally, when we were fighting World War II. And my admiration for these people who can adapt and utilize the tremendous technology that they have at their disposal. And I just want to remind the audience of one thing, and that is that in aerial warfare, you never see the face of your adversary. And as a matter of fact, when you lose a comrade or a crew is shot down or an individual airplane shot down, there is no funeral. There is no memorial. They're gone. And the only thing that is in memory is an empty bunk. So it's an impersonal confrontation, isn't it? Totally. But I certainly do have a great admiration for anybody serving in the military today. I highly recommend it because of the discipline and the knowledge that you can gain, the expertise that you can develop, techniques and utilizing the technology is just absolutely unbelievable. And usually when high school graduates are starting to go to college or consider college, they really don't usually know what they want to do. I didn't. None of my contemporaries did. And so we were sort of at loose ends. The military will give you some direction. And serving, I think it would even be appropriate to require military service of both men and women between high school and college of 2 or maybe a 4-year stretch in the military, and we'd be a much stronger nation.
You speak of admiration for the younger airmen and pilots, and I can say confidently and without a doubt, the feeling is certainly mutual. We have a question over here. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good evening. So you touched on AI and machine learning and pulling in some software engineers and how it's been a little bit difficult. So I work alongside some brilliant engineers, both at university and in work, and I've come into contact with some that don't want to work in military because it's morally wrong for them. And I know that there are some extremes in our society right now. Do you have any advice on what I can do to help, I guess, promote that desire for service and patriotism? Because they're absolutely brilliant, and I think we could really use their intelligence. And I'm kind of hitting a wall on how I can kind of bring them in.
That's a deep question.
Yeah, that is a deep question. You know, the thing I think about here is that we are all doing things for the benefit of our society. And we all serve in different ways. Whether it's in the military, it's in the any type of service, medical career fields, or in the technology provided to make our lives better. And the key goal for the military is to actually do things to make sure we preserve that way of life. And those that help us in the military, they may have an opinion about it, but what our goal here is, as we talked about earlier, and Lucky really hit the nail on the head, we do not want to go to war. We want to do things to prevent going to war, and by working closely together, we make it very difficult for adversaries to want to mess with us and our allies and partners. So what we're all trying to do is protect their way of life so they can enjoy and come to Oshkosh every year, is a good example. Or go to a football game, or go to whatever sporting event, or enjoy life any way you want. But that's what we're trying to get done as a military.
Great question, thank you. We have a question over here.
Yep.
Good evening, thanks for your service. General, what are the challenges you see as you get new people into the Air Force? With today's society, there's quite a stretch. I know, I think a military retiree was part of what happened on January 6th. What are some of your challenges, and what are you trying to do to get the culture you want from a very divisive society that we're all coming from?
Yeah, one of the key areas is we bring folks into our Air Force. What I also realize when people come to the Air Force, this may be their first experience for fill in the blank. First time they've left home, first time they've been out of state, first time they've been in the most more diverse environment. And when they walk in, just because you finish, your 8 weeks of basic training, or 4 years at the Air Force Academy, or go through 4 years of ROTC or whatever, or 3 months of officer training school, doesn't make all of a sudden make you bleed blue. Okay, you got to understand that as you first come in, you folks are going to have to adapt, and we have to work with them to bring them along. I almost quit ROTC after the first semester because this whole thing was my dad's idea. And when I came home, my dad told me, hey, here's the things you got to do to continue to serve. And it wasn't until I went to ROTC summer camp, got a ride in a T-37, I really started having fun. I was going to be an engineer, and I got the bug, and that's when I wanted to start flying. And so it's those things we got to understand about the young people they bring in today and how we meet them where they are, and then help develop them to be great airmen, but also great citizens of our nation. And it's something I'm focused on, and it's more of the aspect of how we coach and mentor and how we develop leaders. And those are things I'm most focused on, and those that share our values that come in. And those that don't share the values, I don't mind showing them the door. Thanks.
I'm so impressed with the questions that you're asking. Speaking of, we've got Jeff down in the front.
Thanks for coming, guys. This, I guess, could apply to anyone, and I wanted to ask kind of a more lighthearted question. Do or did any of y'all fly recreationally, and if so, what do you fly? Outside of your work, obviously.
I almost had zero general aviation experience before I came into the Air Force. My dad was a military fighter pilot my whole life, born on an Air Force base, traveled around, followed him around, but I didn't really get the bug, didn't have the general aviation thing. I think I applied for pilot training with 3 hours in a Cessna 172. But luckily, that's the beauty of the Air Force, right? I went through pilot training with 25 people. One of them was an airline pilot, although it is someone that's never been in a cockpit before. And 1 year later, most of us graduated, and we all went on to fly a variety of different Air Force airplanes. So I'm thankful that the Air Force is able to take me through that path, give me the training that I needed, and teach me how to fly airplanes.
Yeah, so after I got my pilot, I had zero, and I had that T-37 flight, and then I got a pilot slot my senior year of college. So I got probably 12 hours, just enough to solo, and that's it. I've done zero civilian aviation since that time frame. Everything I've been doing is military.
Major Luckadoo, did you fly recreationally after your service?
Yes, I did.
What did you fly?
Well, I had a friend who had a single-engine Bonanza who didn't know how to fly it. And so I offered to teach him how to fly it, which I did. And he said, well, Lucky, you can use this airplane anytime you want to if you just buy the fuel. And I said, you mean that? He said, absolutely. It's better to be used and flown than it is sitting on the ramp. And I said, you're absolutely right. So I flew the wings off of it. But then from that, I graduated to soaring. And that really spoiled me for powered flight. Because you were, as a pilot, we're pitting your skills against the winds and the elements and constantly seeking thermals to stay aloft. And it's the most exhilarating experience in flight that I've ever been privileged to experience.
And now here at Oshkosh, we have the Perlin Project glider, which is soaring upwards of 76,000 feet and soon to hit 100,000. It is just remarkable, even in sailplanes, the technology that is out there. I think we have time for one more question.
All right, over here. Hi. How can those of us civilians who either don't or can't enlist help support those of you who do serve in the Air Force?
Well, just the aspect of how you value our service, you know, and it's not so much that we want to get appreciation. It's the fact that you appreciate what we do, but the other area is how you engage with us and how we are able to engage with you, and that's the beauty of us being here at Oshkosh is for us to be able to connect with you, to because we love what we do. You know, I've been doing this for 37 years, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do when I grow up. because I enjoy serving. And it's just the ability for us to connect with you and us to talk about aviation. And I don't know if I have a good answer for it because I'm starting to ramble right now. But it's the aspect of the, you know, how you appreciate what we're able to do, and then how you you might talk to a young person and tell them how much opportunity there is inside the United States Air Force. We'd appreciate that as well. Thanks.
I'll start down the line, and I'll start with you, Major Luckadoo. What has being a service member taught you about yourself?
Serving as an Air Force member really, in retrospect, it has been extremely valuable in bringing to my mind the realization of the fact that even though we were in the position of serving our country and protecting our freedoms, we still had to think about our own personal effects and what effect it was having on us. And as I mentioned earlier, going to war and being shot at changes and matures anybody instantly. And you realize that you're in a position, an uncomfortable position, of kill or be killed. And that's an awesome realization, because that is not what the good Lord put us on this earth to do. But that's what we end up being confronted with. So, I know the times in which I suffered the worst and had to constantly psych myself up to get back into that airplane the next day and go out and face the enemy again. I often am asked how in the world we did that. And you know, honestly, I don't have a clue. I don't really know how a human being confronted with the adversity that we were thrust in and the conditions in pursuing the war, the Second World War, was going to produce anything positive as far as I was concerned. But you mature overnight. You suddenly realize your position of leadership being thrust upon you, whether you wanted it or not, as a member, as a crew, or as an airplane commander, and in charge of a 10-man crew. So everything you did or didn't do, their lives were dependent upon you. And that's an awesome responsibility, but one you could not deny.
Thank you. Bayo, what has being a service member taught you about yourself?
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up, it's very easy to put yourself in very comfortable situations with people that think like you, look like you, you know, aren't gonna confront you, because that's easy. And then you're thrust into military environment or even a civilian environment, and you have to work alongside or maybe lead people that have completely different mentalities, different morals, different thoughts, ideas, opinions. So whether it's, you know, interacting with the wingmen I'm flying that day or leading them or following them or even leading, you know, a group of airmen like the demo team, It's a challenge that's continuously evolving for me to figure out how do I communicate to these people, figure out what their goals are, what their intent is or their opinions, or why are they, you know, deciding to do something a certain way, and kind of work around those things so we can come to a common goal.
I mean, it's when I read my own biography, I pinch myself because it doesn't seem like me. I just feel like I'm living a dream sometimes. As a matter of fact, the first time I heard my name a couple of weeks into this job, C.Q. Brown and Chief of Staff of the Air Force in the same sentence, it was almost surreal. But it's the opportunity to make a difference, and that's the part that I probably get the most joy out of. The time here at Oshkosh to meet so many different folks and meet many of our airmen and talk to them, and knowing that you're doing things, that you're having an impact, and that to me is what's important about service, is the fact that you're making a difference for somebody by what we are able to do. So I've learned a lot about myself, about leading, and I still study to make myself a better leader, a better husband, a better dad. And so those are the kinds of things I've learned.
I want to take this moment to sincerely and completely thank you for your service. A big round of applause for our panel this evening. Thank you very much, General Brown, Major Wolf, and Major Luckadoo. Thank you.